Usually when we use the word consecration, we're speaking about what happens on the altar during Mass when the priest consecrates the bread and wine, turning it into Christ's body and blood. But looking at the word consecration itself, it means quite simply to make something holy. And when it comes to us, we have all been consecrated to God, beginning with baptism. It took us out of sin. It brought us into a new existence as the sons and daughters of God. And from baptism, we go into different ways of life, thus consecrating ourselves to God's service in a particular way. As we've spoken before, the vast majority of adult Christians are being called to be consecrated to God through the sacrament of holy matrimony when they serve God as they serve their spouses. Some are called to live in a single life, serving God in a single way, to be free to do things outside of the obligations of marriage and family. Then others are called to give themselves in a consecrated life in a certain way to serve God through sacred ministry, through priesthood, or by taking vows and living a certain way of life. Last week I spoke to you all about those who are called in the priesthood, and usually the Sunday closest to the Feast of the Presentation, or in today's case, the Presentation itself, is a day of prayer for those who are in consecrated life. Now, we don't see them as much as we used to, but there are still nuns who are going around. There are monks who live in monasteries, and there are priests who live in religious life, or even brothers who work in the church. But sometimes they have an aura of mystery about them. Remember as a kid, when we see the nuns with their veils and the women below, we would kind of check to see if we could see their hair under there, if they really had hair under their veils and stuff like that. But we have to ask that question, why? Why would somebody consider a religious vocation in a religious order as a brother or a sister? Why would a young man even consider about being a priest? Well, the answer, of course, is to serve God and to seek God. It's seeking God in a particular way, in a much deeper way. Now, as I said, I spoke about priesthood last week, and when you think of a priest, you usually think of what we call a secular or a diocesan priest, which is what I am, Father Jason Vidrine, Father Brian Harrington, Father Brad Gilrey. We're all diocesan priests, which means that we do not belong to a particular religious order, like, say, the Jesuits, Franciscans, or Benedictines. We belong to a particular diocese, in our case, the Diocese of Lafayette. We are ordained for and belong to and will spend the rest of our lives in service to our diocese. And we're under our bishop, who is himself our superior. Unlike those in religious orders, we don't take vows of poverty and chastity and obedience. We take one promise of obedience to the bishop, which, of course, entails that we're going to live a much simpler life and, of course, live and carry out our ministry in the celibate state, but that we also obey him, what he tells us. You know, he assigns us as he sees best for the diocese, the parish, and for ourselves. But there's more than just this one particular way for a Catholic man to serve the church, and there's also a way for women to serve the church as well, and that is in the consecrated life or religious life. As I said, this weekend we're being asked by the church to pray for those who are in consecrated life and to pray for those who are considering serving Christ and his church as a religious. So what is consecrated life? Well, it includes, as I said, some priests, laymen and laywomen, we call them brothers and sisters, whose lives are consecrated, that is, especially dedicated to God and to the church by promising to live what's called the evangelical counsels. That is, three promises they take for a way of life that imitates the very life of Jesus in the gospel, right? That is, to live as Christ did. First of all, to live in poverty. It does not mean destitution, okay? But poverty for the religious means not working for personal profit or for personal gain. They give up the right of ownership of personal property and possessions except what is allowed by a superior. So let's say, for example, I can own my own car. Okay, I can have a checking account. I can own a credit card. Don't make a whole lot of money, but I can still use those things. Whereas, say, my friends who are in religious orders, like the Jesuits, don't have any of that. Okay, they release all that, and what their needs are taken care of by the religious order, by the community. I've got to buy my own clothes and things like that, pay my own gas, etc. They take a vow of chastity, that is, like in celibacy, to live not for one earthly spouse, but for Christ, and not to have one own personal family, but to belong to the entire church, indeed to the entire world. And finally, as we all take, that promise of obedience to one superior, in my case the bishop, in religious life, that is, to the superior of their order, who's elected by the order, and of course by the order's rules and constitutions. So that's basically it. Religious life is a family within a family, just as we, the church, are made up of families. You all have your own families, making up the larger body of the church. So it is in religious life, which is why they use the familial terms, like brother and sister, or they use the terms for father and mother as the leaders of the orders. Now, as usual, popular culture will get the image of religious life wrong. When you see movies and they go into monasteries, what you're ordinarily going to see is some of these dark, dank, medieval-looking places. You're going to hear some singing, that chanting going on, but you never see anybody doing the singing. Okay? But you might catch a glimpse every now and again of a little fat guy with a bald head and a brown robe kind of running around, but not talking to anybody. Or a tall, thin, gaunt man with a heavy beard and piercing eyes that kind of looks very sinister. Again, who never says anything, right? Or you have the pictures of these, you know, these large women with these black veils and these black robes with rulers in their hands, you know, torturing children all the time. That's certainly not the case, right? And they don't live in these dark, dank prisons that, you know, look like medieval torture chambers. It's none of that, okay? There are specific houses that they live, monasteries and convents, that are much like your own houses, just bigger to house more people, okay? With a central kitchen, everybody has their own room, right? But it's a family atmosphere, okay? And they're doing things, serving God, serving the church together with a particular spirit. I know sometimes we like to tell stories. Those of us who went to Catholic school or a catechism who had nuns teaching us, we tell stories about how they were, okay? But sometimes we have to keep in mind that we're telling those stories and remembering those events from the perspective of what we used to be. That as we think about them as children, as teenagers, you know, how the nuns were mean to us. Well, look at it this way. We were kids, okay? Children, teenagers, young people who simply don't like to obey, who don't care for discipline, and of course can be very self-willed, proud, and defiant. Okay? And what were these religious women trying to teach us? Okay? To obey God, our parents, and them, they had to use discipline to break our self-will, to break our pride, and to make us more receptive and humble. So when we think about it as adults now, I think we all know that these men and women who taught us, priests, brothers, sisters, really did love us. And we have to admit that we're much better off for having had them influence our lives. Yeah, as always, there's going to be the odd exception of the bad apple, but those are just that. Those are exceptions. So where all this begin? Where did all this idea of religious life start? It begins very early on, actually, in the early church. From the very beginning, the early Christians lived with the idea and expectation that Jesus was going to come back. His second coming was going to occur in their own lifetime. They were certain of it. St. Paul's writings are very plain about that. He expected that himself. Okay? So they weren't living for an earthly way of life. They were living their lives in expectation of the Lord's coming. Okay? And it was going to happen soon, as they thought. And they prepared themselves for it. They pooled together their resources, right? They didn't want to work for profit, but they took what they had and put it all together. They cared for one another in the difficult times. Widows and widowers who had lost their spouses chose not to remarry. Single persons like St. Paul and some of the apostles chose not to marry. They wanted to imitate Christ in practically every way possible, right? Of how life was going to be in heaven, okay? When we possess nothing, but we all possess God, and God would possess us, okay? Imitating Jesus. They gathered together to pray every day. They celebrated the Eucharist, the Mass every day, and they followed the teaching of the apostles. As we all know, the authorities persecuted them for it. For 300 years, we were hunted people as Christians. So in time, the faith did begin to spread despite the persecutions, but when the sufferings and the martyrdom began to cease, then we saw something that's very familiar to us today. Lots of people who were Christians in name only, but didn't live it or didn't practice it. They began to drift away from their first devotion and their first fervor and just were Christians only by association, by name. So those who were serious, really serious about their faith, began to think about this. And some like-minded believers, with the blessing of their bishops, began to live solitary lives out in the desert. They moved away to places like Egypt and Palestine, not because they hated other people, but they wanted to be alone with God, with no distractions. They didn't want to own anything, didn't want to have any possessions, anything that was going to bother them or break their concentration in meditating and prayer. They did some work. They had their little gardens. They might have manufactured things like, you know, baskets and mats out of palm leaves to sell, to buy bread. But they welcomed strangers who came to see them. They took care of the sick. And they did good things like that. But their whole life was a life of prayer and work centered on God. People began to live together with the same ideas. And small communities began to originate. And they were living like the early Christians. They shared their resources together. They prayed together. They owned nothing. They took care of one another. They were simply trying to be as Christ himself, a light shining in the darkness. They, of course, you know, followed chastity, forsaking the blessing of marriage for the sake of giving themselves entirely to Christ. They lived in obedience to the elders who had been living this life longer than they had, and they were spiritual directors. Or if they had a community, they would elect a leader to guide the community. So in time, you kind of need some organization, so things were written or drawn up. They called them a rule, which just simply means a way of life, saying, this is how we're going to live. This is how we're going to abide and how we're going to incorporate the gospel. So these rules were composed, and orders began to devote themselves to various things in time. Some religious communities were concentrated totally on prayer, and we call them contemplative orders. Okay, they don't go out and work in the world, right? Others did that. They gave themselves to good works and became what we call active orders. And today, we have several different orders or communities of consecrated persons serving the church worldwide. Most of us are familiar with the Marianite sisters who taught at Sacred Heart for many, many years. We have the Holy Family sisters who work at St. Joseph's. We have the Jesuit priests in Grand Coteau who run the retreat center and do some work around the area. Josephite priests who serve black parishes, Divine Word missionaries do the same thing. Those are examples of the active orders we have. But then we have some contemplative, people who don't lock themselves up, but they withdraw from the world as an act of prayer and sacrifice, doing work around their monastery or convent, but they're praying for us who live in the world and have to do things in the world. Two examples of those would be the Benedictine monks who live in Plaisance and the Carmelite sisters who live in Lafayette. So all of these orders, active and contemplative, live and serve in a diocese with the bishop's permission or by his invitation, but they elect their own superiors. Like I said with the priest last week, Villeplatte, this area, can be extremely proud that it's given lots of vocations to religious life, mostly in the Marianite order, but we have one from Queen, who is in the Dominican order, who's serving in Australia. There's one who was born here in Villeplatte, a native son, but grew up in New Orleans. His name is Father Jude Israel, who's a Benedictine monk of St. Joseph Abbey near Covington. Now, there may be others that I'm not aware of, but we have given so many to priesthood and to religious life. So, in sum, the whole point and purpose of religious life is to embody the way of Christ in the gospel. It's to live the Beatitudes and to live the great commandments of Christ, loving God with their whole self and their neighbor, by doing this with others of the same heart and the same mind, united together. It's living in the spirit and example of the great founders of their religious orders and communities. And those would be saints like Francis of Assisi and St. Clare, St. Ignatius Loyola, St. Benedict and St. Scholastica, St. Dominic, St. Teresa of Avila, St. Catherine Drexel, and Henriette de Lisle. But all of these continue to do that great work of Christ by being free from the obligations of the world to serve Christ completely and give themselves no matter what they may be called to do. Many of them, as we know, had to leave not just their families, but their entire homeland, their country, venturing out to other places, bringing the gospel where it was most needed. So let's continue to pray for that, to pray for those who have affected our lives in a positive way in the past, those great priests and religious who have done good for us, those who are serving now, and for those who are considering it. And of course, I would encourage you, as always, to encourage your own sons and daughters to consider the religious life. Have them think about it, pray about it. Your granddaughters, your nephews, your nieces, everyone else, that whatever vocation God is calling us to, we'll embrace it wholeheartedly, give ourselves completely for his glory and the good of the world. That all of us, no matter what our vocation might be, may bring the light of Christ to the world in our powerlessness and our nothingness to manifest the great power of God's love.